Today on the Monocle Weekly Edition 95, we're back in Tokyo, where we'll be getting the latest news on the earthquake and tsunami relief efforts in the north of the country.
One of the main issues, it seems to be, is coordination with the central government in Tokyo. There's some confusion and they don't know when money's coming and they don't know when the decisions are going to be made.
That was Lindsay Whipp, Tokyo correspondent for the Financial Times. And we'll also be discussing what impact the disaster is having on traditional Japanese craft businesses.
We definitely have to come up with new products. People are not buying extremely expensive pieces of furniture anymore. What we're doing right now for the Tohoku region in particular is to come up with semi-permanent houses that people can live in for at least, you know, several years, if not longer.
That was Dan Inamoto of furniture and architecture company Oak Village. And later in the program, Verbal from M-Flow will be playing us some new music, and we'll be talking to Yujiro Taniyama, a candidate in last week's election for Tokyo governor, about what the future holds for Japan.
I think this is a big opportunity for Japan to change. The most important thing is our mentality. We're sharing this emotion that we have to do something, and this is something we, the Japanese, hadn't experienced for a long time.
And now, from Tokyo, the Monocle Weekly.
Hello, it's Sunday, April 17th, 2011, and you're with the Monocle Weekly here in Tokyo. I'm Tyler Brulé, along with our Asia Bureau Chief Fiona Wilson and Tokyo Editor Kenji Hall. Hello.
Hi there.
It's been 5 weeks since we were here, not in this studio, but certainly when I arrived last week, it seems that the mood has lifted a little bit in Tokyo. I'm not sure if you'd agree, being residents, Fiona.
I don't know. I feel like the roller coaster continues. You know, you have good days and bad days. The news is so mixed. You know, we had the news this week that the catastrophe had been raised to a level 7, along with some news that they seem to be slightly improving the situation at Fukushima. So it was a bit mixed.
Kenji?
I think I have to agree with that. We still have the daily airborne radiation levels that are reported. We still have the water radiation levels reported. So it hasn't returned back to a normal situation yet, but I get the sense that gradually we're getting there.
And in gradually, do you think it's almost just, certainly if we're talking about the radiation issue, it just becomes something of a daily risk that, you know, it's like riding a bicycle without a helmet or anything else. This is just something that you're going to have to live with.
Definitely. I mean, it seemed so surreal at first, everyone talking about radiation and thinking about radiation. But it's become quite normal now to be buying bottled water, you know, just to reading these this data every day and trying to make sense of it.
And because it is interesting even when I was here a few weeks ago, the convenience stores were well and truly cleared out. And now there are just select holes. And you go in and you're trying to think, what's missing here? And then, you know, you go into one Family Mart, then you go into 7-Eleven, you realize, well, there's no dairy and there's no beer.
Well, dairy is coming back, I think, in the supermarket.
Okay, not the Family Mart I was in anyway. could have been time of day. But
the one thing that I noticed that's still missing is natto, that lovely, stinky, fermented bean that people love to eat for breakfast and for dinner.
Yeah, that right. I don't miss at all. Yeah, so okay. No,
I was going to say, I'm not going to be clearing the shelves of that. Don't worry. But it was interesting because I was down in Osaka and then I was in Kagoshima last weekend. And it is a bit of almost sort of a tale of two countries because, you know, even Osaka, it's swarming with French people. I saw sort of, you know, happy French people on bicycles all over the place. I'm not kidding. So, you know, this is obviously where you're looking for your neighbors because Kenji lives in a particularly French part of Tokyo. They're sort of, you know, running around sort of Ueda and in other parts of town.
So they've come back to Japan, but they haven't come back to Tokyo.
Yeah, they're not coming back to Tokyo. but it is something like that, no?
Oh, definitely. I mean, I spent a bit of time in Kyoto and it wasn't like it hadn't happened, but, you know, the shelves were full, no problem with electricity, none of the worries that are really affecting people here still. I mean, and it's funny you're talking about convenience stores because the one next to the Monocle office, which has these patchy holes, is also half lit, which is something that's become quite normal, but actually is quite a strange thing in Tokyo at the moment that still stations, shops, all half lit.
Absolutely. Just walking down the street here outside the studio, it was completely dark. Yeah, I mean, thought, am I supposed to be on this road?
Well, that's
and is it safe.
Yeah, I mean, and you know, certainly in an area like this, that normally you sort of look down these, you know, side streets with, you know, sort of, you know, brightly lit bars and everything else, and it's almost sort of an alley that you wouldn't want to go down. Maybe we should sort of turn our attention to the other side of the country, though. Lindsay Whipp is also here from the Financial Times. You were just up north. You're just back. Was it your first tour up there or second?
It was my second time. Soon after the earthquake and tsunami happened, my colleague and I, we tried to get straight up there and initially failed and managed to get our way up there by plane in the end. So we spent a week up there then, and so this time I spent 4 days up there by myself.
And, well, I guess the first thing is, you know, we were talking about it last time with Fiona, was just the issue of logistics for journalists and cars. But did you already notice a difference at this point?
Definitely, because the first time we went up there, we got the last car, I think, over in Yamagata, which is actually quite a long way away from, you know, where all the problems are, where the disaster is. But this time we managed to get a car straight away up in Hanamaki, which was obviously a lot easier and a lot less driving.
Mm. I guess just to compare and contrast, and I'm not sure if you were in the same places. Did you return to the same areas where you reported from the first time, or you went into to fresh territory?
I did both, actually. I went to Likazen Takata, which is actually one of the probably the worst hit, and Ofunato, which is just up the road. And then I went into a new place down in Miyagi that I'd never been to, I mean, rather than it being a new place, Ishinomaki, which is a much larger place. And I was driven by some locals up the coastline there. So that was a very new experience. The funny thing was, when we first went to Likazen Takata, we'd driven for so long to get there. It was actually getting almost dark when we arrived. And I didn't actually realise the devastation I initially saw on the first Sunday. I didn't realise that that was only a small part of the town. I thought that was a town, and I was still absolutely horrified. And so going back this time, and I drove in further because the self-defence forces have cleared so many of the roads, you go in and it's just enormous, and it's still, I mean, the only thing that's really been done is that the roads have been cleared. And so instead of having like debris and rubble and people's clothes and photographs and things strewn everywhere, they're in huge piles.
Mm.
So the sort of impact doesn't diminish with time, really, in that sense.
And from a, I guess, infrastructure and an organizational point of view, because, you know, we've obviously seen a lot of stories and sort of the wonder of Japan that, of course, highways have been repaired and, you know, there's you know, even sort of the partitions between lanes have, you know, already been, you know, completely re-landscaped, etc. Obviously, that's not the situation there. But from a, you know, from a logistical and an organizational point of view, are they coping?
They're definitely coping. There are certain towns, like with Likazen Takata, where, like as you said, the town office isn't really functioning because it's not there anymore, or it's not usable. And obviously a lot of the staff have been washed away. But they're doing whatever they can. But you can see behind, you know, they're really trying and they're doing an incredible job. But you can see there's a very thin line between sort of working all these hours every day, coping with lost family and no homes, and trying to rebuild and get relief efforts into action. And then on top of that, I think one of the main issues it seems to be is coordination with the central government in Tokyo. I'm not sure exactly how the communication is going, but it does seem that there's some confusion and they don't know when money's coming and they don't know when the decisions are going to be made. And so there's a lot of kind of foggy areas above their heads and they're just wondering what's happening.
Mm. And from an FT perspective, what were you looking for? What type of stories?
Well, obviously the first week we went up there, a lot of the focus was on, you know, obviously just the horrific devastation and then, you know, the plight of people, which is something we're still interested in and focus on. But, you know, as a business newspaper, we do have to sort of look ahead and look at how they're coping in terms of moving on from relief efforts into rebuilding and how to rebuild, how communication is going on with the prefectural governments and then also the central government, and really the extent to which businesses want to rebuild there.
Mm. I mean, Fiona, we heard that Tadao Ando will take up a post in terms of being part of this Reconstruction Design Council. A shrewd move, or do you think it's just something of a PR name? And not to be cynical about it, but it's something which it's a name that people recognize in Japan, but also internationally as well.
I mean, I think that helps, but he was also involved in the rebuilding after Kobe, so he does have some form on that front. I mean, they have set themselves quite a tall order that they're going to announce their proposals in June, which is not that far off. And, you know, from what Lindsay's saying, I don't think it's anywhere close to reconstruction territory. But I think it was meant to be a sort of positive move and a group of thinkers, really. I mean, if you look at the makeup of that council, it's a very eclectic bunch.
Yeah.
It wasn't the obvious names. And I mean, maybe that's what makes it interesting.
But I do think that actually what's quite interesting is that they aren't, especially places like Likazen Takata, aren't anywhere near ready to go into the rebuilding side of it. But they do want the central government to be there. they want them to be on that path already, because if they don't, then it's going to be too late. And I think that's one of the concerns, is what's going to happen down the road.
Mm. I mean, from a PR point of view as well, I guess if the Japanese can set themselves any task, and if certainly from a purely sort of brand Japan perspective, many things have not been well organized, through the lens of the rest of the world. If they set themselves a task of going and rebuilding towns, they'll probably hit the deadlines.
No, I think everyone has faith that they'll. If they say they're going to do it, they will do it. But I mean, even these prefab homes, I mean, they've been held up by so many logistical issues that I'm sure Lindsay knows a lot more about. But, the problem with the roads, the petrol, getting the materials.
And the supply of materials,
They've
had to ship some of them from Tokyo, and even then there's been a shortage in Tokyo, so... that's sort of holding up the relief effort as well.
I mean, what types of business stories did you find this time? Because I was in Osaka earlier in the week, and was visiting the people from Panasonic, and they on one side they said we're quite fortunate because yes, we have plants all over the country, but a lot of it is focused in Kansai. But they talked about their flagship camera production for Lumix. They said there is one essential piece, a small Panasonic factory, but they said production's finished. They said it's until we either move capacity somewhere else, but they said all of the machinery was there, and they said we're not making cameras right now.
Right, right. I mean, that's the extraordinary thing. I think that before this happened, I don't think people really realised just how important this, very rural part of Japan is to the global supply chain. And suddenly, with companies like Shin-Etsu Chemical and Renesas says they just can't produce these tiny little essential, components. And then you also have the bigger story, not just the component story, but you have in Ishinomaki, for example, you have Nippon Paper, one of its entire factories, which produces a significant amount of its, annual production, it's gone or unusable. I drove past it and it's just like huge rolls of paper everywhere.
And just, you were talking to also one of the biggest developers in the country, and that, two essential things, they need glass and steel, that they hope that they can get their hands on it to get started on one of their developments.
That's right, absolutely. That was Mori Building saying that they, they're worried that construction will have to slow down, which they really don't want. But interestingly, you talk about paper, because they suddenly realised they couldn't publish any of their publicity material because all the paper was coming from Tohoku. So, and they asked the suppliers, can you get anything else? And they said, we have a warehouse, but it's in Ureasu, which is the area of Tokyo, outside Tokyo, which has been liquefied. It's interesting, two different parts of the country affected by the situation.
I just want to go back to you being up north, Lindsay. Were there still a lot of international journalists on the scene? I mean, of course, we've seen most of the major rolling news organizations have largely pulled out. And I mean, you still see they've got one or two correspondents here that... traditionally are not in Japan. But what was it like from a media perspective up there now?
Well, there was definitely still international media up there. In Nikkei and Takata, there was ABC were there and AFP. And also there's a guy up there who's from Nikkei and Takata but works in Tokyo during the week. And he'd lost three of his homes. His family, luckily, okay. But he's helping out very much. And so he can do press conferences in English. So, that's a great help for the town, really, because obviously there's not too many people there who have that ability.
I just wanted to ask all of you, because Fiona, you were saying that when it comes to let's put presentation aside, but when it just comes to getting the facts, NHK is still the source. And I was surprised watching the morning bulletin, the 7 a.m. bulletin, that every day the 30 minutes, right up until they do traffic and weather, 30 minutes is only the story of the disaster. Nothing, I mean, I was even sort of looking when there was, let's say last week, there were the shootings in Rio de Janeiro, et cetera. None of that made the news. And I'm wondering, do you think we're at a point where you do have to sort of look at the mix as well, where, we're 5 weeks into this or not? I mean, maybe it's a good thing that you can't leave the story, because I think probably more from a Western media perspective, everyone else, would move on even if it happened in the north of England.
And from my perspective, I think that maybe it's in the UK, it'd be slightly different. But here, I don't know whether those shootings would have made the telly anyway. It's very much more a domestic-focused news flow.
Mm.
And it doesn't surprise me that they're still focused tremendously on this, because there's just been too much devastation for it to be knocked off, I think, for a long time yet.
Kenji?
One of the things that Mr. Imai mentioned when I spoke to him, he's the executive director of news at NHK, one of the things he mentioned was that NHK wanted to be this partner with the people who are still in the shelters. And so it seemed more, you know, news wasn't necessarily the priority. It was that they were there and that they were still reporting what people needed and, you know, what people lacked. And so I don't think you can look at NHK as a traditional news organization. I mean, in many ways, I mean, they are a state-funded organization. And so if you watch the sort of gradual transformation of the news over the course of the past 5 weeks, they went from reporting hard news to interrupting the news with these segments where they would ask, they would go into the evacuation centers and ask people, what do you need? You know, who do you want to shout out to? That sort of thing. So it was very much a community
bulletin, public service in the truest
absolutely.
Sense. Absolutely. I mean, Fiona, I'm not sure much you're sort of flipping the dial and sort of looking at NTV and TV Asahi, et cetera, but you know, is it the same thing when you see other bulletins or they're playing with volume slightly differently?
No, I think NHK is still the sort of dominant channel for disaster coverage. And I think it's doing done a very good job. And I think it's true that people are just not ready to leave the story. And you know, if you sit down at dinner with people, very quickly that's what the subject becomes. It becomes about this, you know, earthquake, tsunami, nuclear situation in some form or other. So I think that really they're reflecting what the public is feeling, actually.
Yeah, I guess what is interesting, when you sort of looked at also the variety of stories, it sort of did span every single sort of human business aspect as well, because, you know, at a point, I think I was watching at the weekend, and it sort of jumped to sort of, you know, a figure skating fundraiser. And then it went to sort of, you know, a happy story about, you know, yet another center, you know, getting their, not thermal baths, but certainly getting their hot baths as well, which is sort of, you know, really sort of that human interest piece as well. Lindsay, just before we go, is there sort of a rhythm that you've come up with in the Bureau here as to how much you'll go into the zone? This is something that, you know, you'll be sort of mixing it up with your fellow correspondents here, that this is, I mean, obviously you have to stick to, because there's such a big supply chain issue, you know, as a baseline for the FT. But yeah, will it be a cycle then?
Yeah, I mean, I think we're all going to take turns in going up there, whether it's to Fukushima or whether it's further up north. I think for us, in many respects, the Tokyo Electric story is an enormous one. I mean, it has so many implications globally, as you realise. I mean, you know, sort of the future of nuclear energy being just one. So that we'll obviously, within sort of safety limits, we'll be reporting on that as much as possible on the ground. But again, with the supply chain, I mean, at the moment, sort of when I was up north, that people were sort of confident that the companies would come back and rebuild. But as time goes on, I do wonder to what extent they will sort of hold to that promise in whatever form it came in, because will they decide that actually we've got overcapacity in Japan anyway? Do we really need to rebuild? Can't we use this as an excuse? They can't do it right now, but because obviously it'd be too offensive, but could they do that in the future? And what happens if it gets to a point in time when these components that can't be built here or can't be supplied here anymore are supplied in Taiwan or Korea? And the company's like, well, let's just continue with these new suppliers. So I think that's an enormous question that we just have to keep following.
You know, obviously, Japan's very much been under the microscope. And it's been interesting to sort of see also how, you know, the goodwill meter, I think, also swings quite a bit as well. But I was talking to a diplomat from a government that will remain unnamed, but he said that he felt that in terms of a catastrophe, it wasn't big enough to make real change. So he said, I think it's great that the Prime Minister's office talks about what needs to be done for Brand Japan, that we have to polish our presentation skills. There's many things that we need to look at, particularly when we're going to be in front of the lens on the world stage. And I just wanted to ask all of you, what do you make of a comment like that, Fiona?
Yeah, it's an interesting one there. I mean, I think the way the government has handled information has been rather patchy, to be honest. At some points you think, no, they're doing their best. And then you really feel like you're not getting the full story, or they tip 10,000 tonnes of contaminated water and then mention it to the neighbouring countries. And you think, really, could have been handled better. So, I mean, I'm not surprised neighbouring countries are trying to be supportive, but at the same time, they you know, they want to see a bit more leadership, probably.
Kenji?
I'm with Fiona on that. I think in many ways they've given the public too much information. It's indigestible, really. Nobody understands what it means. And I think they need to sort of craft the message a little bit more.
Lindsay?
No, I agree. I mean, I think on those two points, I mean, firstly, the sort of sometimes there's this lack of context as to what any of these numbers mean. And
becquerels and millisieverts.
Right. So you're sitting there thinking, I should know this. And I don't know whether to be worried or not. And you just don't get that context to the extent that would just make life so much easier for everybody who's here.
Mm.
And then likewise for, obviously, for, you know, if you're in Korea or China or Russia near a border, you do want to know before it happens what's going to go into the sea that could eventually flow your way. So, I mean, hopefully Tokyo's learnt that lesson this time. But and apparently I think the US, they informed the US, I think, beforehand. But I don't know how you pick your...
Well, I guess you pick your biggest allies, don't you? Lindsay Whipp for the Financial Times, thanks very much.
Thank you.
Fiona, Kenji, stick around. You're listening to The Monocle Weekly. We're in Tokyo. We're back after this. Welcome back to The Monocle Weekly. Over the past few weeks, a lot has been reported on the recent disaster's impact on Japan's large multinationals, with the breaking down of essential production lines and crippling fuel shortages. But what has the impact been on the country's wealth of small businesses that focus on local trades and traditional craftsmanship? Joining me now in studio is Dan Inamoto from the family-run woodcraft business Oak Village. And you might also recognize the voice from the recent story that we had on our program on Bloomberg as well. Dan Inamoto, welcome.
Thank you, and I'm honored to be here.
Thank you. I wanted to start, we have been touching on it, and it certainly cropped up in the columns on our site, and in the next issue, I think we also, you know, focus on the smaller issue, because I think while everyone's been, of course, you know, looking at, you know, what has this meant for Panasonic, as we were saying earlier on, you know, we've been speaking to people who we know from, you know, let's say smaller retailers in this country who say, look, there's a shirt maker, which was a 4 or 5 person operation. Still can't find them.
Right.
That there is, you know, someone who is, you know, doing small ceramics for us. Can't find those people as well. And I guess from your perspective, Dan, what do you think will happen? Because I guess on one side of the world, there's been this extraordinary awareness boom just for Japan in general, and in many ways from a fundraising point of view, we've seen, you know, large art exhibitions in New York. You know, we've seen designers coming together in London, and you know, a lot of it is, you know, smaller crafted items. And I'm wondering, you know, what you think this means for your sector.
Right, right. I mean, I think there's something special about Japan that attracts people to want to help. Like you said, art exhibitions and all kinds of people trying to help out financially or otherwise. For us small businesses, it's definitely going to be very, very difficult for us in particular. Our sales has gone down for sure. And we also build houses. And it's been difficult for us to get materials to build houses. We haven't been directly affected in a sense that, you know, our workers are fine and our factory is not damaged. But we can't get glass, for example, to make windows. We can't get toilet equipment. And so we have a house that's being built that's almost complete right now, but we can't hand it over to the client because we haven't quite finished it.
Mm.
But I think there is going to be sort of a change in direction in ways people think about development, in that Japan has obviously grown very fast after World War II and achieved a certain point of economic wealth. But there's also a trend, I think, now that's looking back at the past and the culture that we've built, which is about sustainability. We use materials like wood, paper made out of natural resources. And these things can last even in the face of disasters like this. So I hope that there will be a look back at the past type of direction coming out of this.
Mm.
Yeah.
Fiona, do you think there's going to be, you know, at a point, a buy made in Japan boom? You know, certainly with, you know, domestically anyway, that there will actually be maybe a concerted call to action by the government?
No, I think there may be a more of a sort of general mood that people want to help small businesses. I mean, I noticed I was in a restaurant the other night and they had a tohoku menu. I have to say it was sake. It was no food or anything that might alarm people. But no, I think there's so much goodwill towards and people want to help out in whatever way they can. So I think maybe one of the problems is the dreaded self-restraint that everyone's talking about, that consumers are really holding back.
Yeah.
I don't know if that's affecting you.
Definitely, yeah. I mean, I think Japanese people are amazing sometimes in a sense that they, once they decide to do something that is not forced upon them, they will do it just because that's the mood of the country. Mm. Yeah, I mean, I agree with you. I think people need to sort of look at the future now, you know, start thinking about what we can do in order to rebuild instead of just sort of restraining themselves. Mm.
Do you think that the other day the Prime Minister, Naoto Kan, said that, you know, we should stop exhibiting this self-restraint, we should right. start spending in order to support right. the Tohoku region. Do you think that will have any sort of psychological effect on people?
Prime Minister's comment itself? I'm not so sure, well, you know, unfortunately. I think he's a little bit under pressure right now, so I don't know if people are taking it you know, directly as a recommendation and will act upon it. But I think people will eventually, you know, start to buy things as they used to. But I think they will be more careful when they choose things. Like I said, I think, you know, I hope that people will look at well-crafted material or well-crafted products that will last for a long time and that are made out of things that are not necessarily dangerous to the environment or to themselves, and look at, I mean, obviously energy resources as well. So hopefully, you know, we'll get to a point where the economy is once again back up. Mm.
Fiona, do you think that this issue actually forces something that was already happening? And by that, I mean, it's, you know, it's a topic we have spent a lot of time on, which is the rejection in this country of traditional luxury. And, you know, I was walking through, you know, Marunouchi, and it's just interesting to see, you know, this cavernous Burberry store, which, okay, fine, of course it was, you know, it was empty, and it was, you know, 7:30 in the evening. But two doors down, you wouldn't have seen this on Nakadori before, but there was a shop which actually you would have liked. It was sort of very sort of, you know, linen and lots of sort of smocky things, and it was called Plain Clothes, and it was, you know, everything was sort of, you know, very, you know, of that sort of, you know, Japanese back to the earth aesthetic. And that wouldn't have, I don't know, that shop wouldn't have been there 18 months ago even, but now, you know, suddenly it can actually, it does seem luxurious. And I'm wondering, is, you know, is that going to be the new mood as well, that we might see sort of more Burberry stores? Well, I mean, that one's pretty big, but just, you know, potentially sort of evaporating. And there almost becomes sort of a new retail narrative in this country.
And I think people, as you were saying, had already started to move away from that conventional idea of luxury. You know, definitely there's been this huge move towards farmers markets, all the things we know about, which may now be affected quite badly by what's happening. And I think companies like Dan's, which have made a virtue out of using materials that come from here, sustainability, reforesting, I think those things are all really important to people. I mean, we've been talking about this redefinition of luxury for a while now, and I think it's absolutely true. But I mean, even not at a luxury level, I mean, and it was nothing to do with the earthquake. I mean, you walk around Harajuku, the Mori girls, the forest girls are out in force, you know, the smock wearers. I really don't look like one. It might be alarming for people who think I now just walk around in a smock. But, you know, that I think that mood was already there. And I think this may tap into that. I mean, maybe that's wishful thinking on our part.
Kenji, do you think that we'll see, you know, a redefinition, not just on the luxury side, but, you know, we're all sort of trying to find our way here. And it is amazing how important the convenience store is as a landmark in the city. You know, every restaurant, you know, that we seem to like, you know, it's always, you know, how many meters is it from, you know, a Family Mart or a Lawson. And you know, so we've been through this period where these are punctuation points on the landscape, but, you know, all this, or at least half of the strip lighting is turned down. And I wonder if, you know, when it comes to the mid-year board meeting, that there is just, you know, whether it's a simple rethink on energy, there's actually been findings because of, and I would imagine that there is, you know, a lot of research, and people are sort of poring over the numbers every day. Yeah, will things be reshaped, do you think, as a result?
Well, that's what I'm hoping. There's already an institute called the Institute for Sustainable Energy, and they've looked at this possibility of switching over to more sustainable energy. And this one gentleman, Ida-san, said that he thinks Japan can go from 10% now to about 20 to 30% by 2020, and by 2050, that we could actually be at 100%, which I find to be a little overly ambitious. Mm. But, you know, there are people who are thinking about this very issue of where do we go from here? You know, obviously we can't be using the same amount of energy that we have because Tokyo Electric Power doesn't have the power to provide to us. So, you know, this, I think this summer in particular, when we see shortages, when you know, people go without air conditioning,
yeah,
or decide to flip off the lights and use candles instead. They're already doing it, but I think we're going to have to see more of that as the year progresses.
What boggles my mind is that the only country in the world to have suffered from atomic bombs is dependent on nuclear power. You know, we've known the atrocities that this technology can cause. I'm not necessarily saying that we should, you know, do away with nuclear power entirely. But I mean, you know, I think if we can invest the kind of money that we're investing in nuclear power, we have to be able to come up with something new, something you know, that can replace it at least partially.
Looking across the months ahead, I guess, what are the contingencies that you have from a production point of view, and what will you sort of put in place then?
Well, we definitely have to come up with new products that are appealing to the consumers in this kind of economy. People are not buying extremely expensive pieces of furniture anymore. That's been the case in general, but now more so. What we're doing right now for the Tohoku region in particular is to come up with one somewhat semi-permanent houses that people can live in. So not just prefab temporary houses, but houses that people can live in for at least you know, several years, if not longer, and to build them as cheaply as possible.
Mm.
So we're going to submit a proposal to the government for the houses. And then two, furniture that can be built very economically, but also can be put together easily by the people. So it doesn't necessarily take a craftsman to build it. So we're making a proposal for that. And then reforesting the areas that have been devastated by the tsunami. I think having a rich forest will help rebuild clean river and then obviously the sea. So those three things are the main sort of activities that we're doing right now. And we're hoping to come to a point where we can actually help the people directly through those proposals.
Dan Inamoto from Oak Village. Fiona, it sounds like he's pitched us about sort of three stories.
I was just thinking that. I had my notebook out.
I was going to say, God, you know, between you and Kenji, it's sort of, you know, fighting for the assignment. But there's, I mean, well, I'll look at it is best of luck with those projects coming
Thank
up.
Thank you.
Thanks very much. You listen to the Monocle Weekly. We're in Tokyo. We're back after this. Back with the Monocle Weekly in Tokyo, where it's time for culture. And in the absence of Rob Bound, we have the lovely Mr. Verbal from MFlow, who's going to try to keep things a little bit genki for us today. Verbal, welcome.
Hey, welcome back to Tokyo.
I saw you 5 weeks ago, and we had a very rapid cookie and coffee at Starbucks, and you slipped something into my bag at that point, and we were talking, about various initiatives that were in the works. The thing that you slipped my bag was a new album that's just come out, which we'll talk about in a second.
Sure.
But I'm wondering what's we've seen a lot of Japanese celebrities, actors, sports people, musicians going into other markets. So going to Singapore, going to Taiwan, going to Korea to do fundraisers. But I'm actually wondering, it'd be interesting to hear what's actually happened with artists here in terms of, special charity albums, collaborations, all of those types of things.
Yeah. Well, as you probably know, a lot of Japanese artists have donated certain sums of money. They have done charity projects. And what I've noticed is that, and this is the general feel of the, all the artists and record companies right now, is that we need to do this for a long time. So some of the projects that we're being involved in involves actually going into these affected areas and really working with the individual shelters.
Mm.
And, that's the kind of direction that, I'm thinking about.
Fiona, are you surprised there hasn't been a Band-Aid coming together of, every star on EMI, AVEX, every sort of label piling into a studio yet, and that there's not a number one here? Or
maybe
it wouldn't quite work like...
Yeah. Is that coming? I don't know. I mean, I've noticed SMAP, who the boy band.
Yeah.
Can we still call them a boy band? The man band.
Man band, yeah.
But I notice them on TV quite a lot with their We Believe in the Strength of Japan.
Mm.
They're sort of more high profile, but I don't know. Is there any plan? Is there a plan to do an album?
Like a mega thing, just getting 40 artists together?
Like a We Are the World kind of thing.
Yeah.
Well, you know what? To tell you the truth, I think that's what's difficult in Japan. Like, people try to do that and it just kind of doesn't happen. Unfortunately, I've seen a little bit of, riding on this whole situation and trying to look like they're doing the best thing in the whole world. And it's been hard for record companies to get together. I mean, I've I mean, I'm in the industry, so I hear about, like, well, what about the percentages at a time like this, you know?
Really, even now?
Even now, yeah.
Really?
But then there are, let's put this, you know, bad story aside, like bad mouthing aside, but like there's a lot of artists who are really just trying to get together and like start something. And I have been getting a lot of support from overseas artists, one of which being Kylie Minogue, who's coming next week. You know, so
well, it's great that she's coming as well.
Yeah, I mean, it's great that she's coming and she's going to tell the rest of the world that it's okay for her to come to Japan. But, you know, I mean, to answer your question, sorry, long intro, but yeah, it's it's been really hard to do like a mega We Are the World kind of thing.
Mm. Yeah. Well, also, it must have been hard because I said when I saw you a few weeks ago, you have a new solo project out.
Yeah.
What a time to launch it.
No, you know what? I mean, it's and one of the song being called Blackout. You know, I mean, it was kind of like in that.
That was going to be what the debut single.
Yeah, that was kind of like the single. But you know, I mean, when the album was released, the CDs were actually already in the stores, so I had no control over the release. I mean, actually, I didn't think it was a good timing, obviously. But yeah, after the earthquake, I mean, promotion wasn't on my mind, obviously. Mm. You know, I've been getting together with artists, especially you know, been in contact with Blaze from Monkey Magic, because he lives in Sendai, the affected area, and he lives in a shelter and simultaneously, you know, volunteers as well. And we've been speaking on more like grassroots projects, like how we could get things out there quicker.
Mm.
You know, I think an earlier guest was speaking about how they could get resources to affected areas quicker than through the government. And that's exactly what he's talking about. I'm really kind of, I would say, like very involved in that right now.
Fiona, that's quite remarkable. I mean, for people who don't know Monkey Magic, we're quite a big deal here, and I think a big deal, you know, in the fact they're also from Sendai, but I don't think you can see a lot of British artists or otherwise of that level sort of living in a shelter part-time.
I mean, they waited on the first Virgin flight to
L.A.
Yeah. I mean, it was amazing.
Is he doing it by choice or...
Yeah, he's the... Yeah, I mean...
Or
I
is
mean,
it a solidarity thing?
Yeah.
You know what? It was... well, the first thing after the earthquake, I was like, wow, you know, you see all the videos, you know, the footage. And I thought immediately, Sendai, man, Monkey Magic, my friends, and among others, you know, in those affected areas. So I called him and obviously the phone wouldn't connect. A couple days later, he wrote back. He's like, I'm okay, living in a shelter. I mean, he showed me a photo of his, you know, his house, and there's a huge crack in his wall. And, you know, obviously he can't live there. So, you know, living in a shelter, he goes around to places like Shichigahama, that's one of the places, and tells me, you know, okay, these kids need like 50 sneakers. You know, I thought.
So
like,
you go into your wardrobe at that point.
Well, and among, you know, I also call upon some of my friends from like Reebok or Gap who, you know, donated a lot of kids' shoes. And, you know, so there's a lot of friends in the fashion and music who are willing to help and, you know,
that's what's been interesting is the amount of very small scale grassroots things that are happening and people literally, I mean, like this is also with infrastructure also having sort of bounced back, but you know, people using you know, Sagawa or whatever, you know, Takubin company to send things up there.
Yeah, because we were also hearing about, you know, school children needing satchels. I mean, just small things that you think how important are they, but to a group of school children it's very important, isn't it?
Yeah, I mean, obviously, as artists, we do other projects and we try to launch new things. Like, for example, you know, we're currently talking about MTV VMAJ this year. It's not going to be Video Music Awards Japan. It's going to be Video Music Aid Japan. So artists aren't going to go up on stage to receive awards. They're going to go up and give messages. And for the after party, which I'm supposed to be producing, it's not going to be really a party. I'm planning on doing like a huge flea market and auction to have, you know, Uber artists give items. So that in that way, I'm doing like a mini We Are the World kind of thing. Artists, you know, I've...
When will that be? When is the video?
June 25th.
Right.
So I'm trying to do this thing where artists actually do the flea market, sell the items. I mean, it's like a more of an awareness thing, but, you know, trying to use my connections to...
I could see that becoming a... That. You know, I think... It's just what MTV needs right now. They need a new franchise. So I think the idea of the global flea market is a good one. You came to studio to also bring some Genki cheer on a Sunday. Yeah. I guess I saw some CDs in your bag. What are you going to play for us first?
I just spoke about Kylie. So why don't I play Kylie's I Should Be So Lucky?
Sweet.
Well, that was the Ms. Minogue, and I guess her fans should be so lucky, because it is quite something. I was corresponding with her, and the fact that she is going to use this as a message to say, look at, because there's been, and this one, just the amount of things that have been cancelled, from sporting events through to, I mean, I don't know how many artists I think must have cancelled who had things on the horizon, well, not on the horizon, but things that should have happened over the last, you know, 4 or 5 weeks.
Yeah, and then, you know, as you probably know, a lot of event companies, like, folded because of that. You know, like, all the events that were supposed to happen just got cancelled, like, months ahead. Mm. So, you know, it was very discouraging. But for someone like Kylie to come, and, you know, as you probably know, too, like, personally, she's, like, the one who's spearheading the rest of the staff, like, saying, it's okay, let's go. Mm. And then, you know, the announcement was made officially a couple of days ago, saying, you know, Kylie's going to be here. I mean, everyone was excited. Mm. You know, that's going to be one of the big events of the, you know, after the earthquake.
Fiona, you've got an option, because I've heard there's a water show involved. So we could probably sort out tickets, but it's going to involve sort of, you know, a poncho of some sort, a rubberized poncho, I believe.
Oh, I'm just a bit worried about that. Can I sit in the seats where you don't get soaked, please? Yeah.
Kenji, will you be there? In trunks.
With my, exactly.
I want to ask you about this album, though, because there was, you know, the big finale, M-Flow concert. I believe there might be more M-Flow again on the horizon, but there's obviously been the solo project in between. So tell us about this album.
Well, basically, you know, it was a lot of people around me, big artists, you know, and, you know, just my fans were always asking me, like, why don't you do a solo? And never really thought about it. You know, I'm more like the, you know, cheerleader, you know, like in M-Flow, like working with Taku, making a song, Teriyaki Boys making a song. So, you know, it was a good process, like, you know, like finding myself kind of thing, you know, found my sound. Mm. So, I mean, it was good, you know, and you probably heard the album.
Yeah. Yeah. What are you going to play for us?
I'm going to play I Can't Help Myself.
Very nice.
Thank you.
Where does that rank in terms of your favorites?
Well, this came down pretty quickly. I mean, I wrote this in like 15 minutes, so I mean, I think it was pretty I guess it was in me, you know, I needed to let it out somewhere. So yeah, it ranks pretty high, I guess. Yeah.
What's your favorite though off the album?
Man, I mean, I like this song, and there's another song called You Are. Mm-hmm. Where I'm kind of like singing, but I touched it up a bit because I'm kind of embarrassed of my actual singing voice.
I like that, touched it up.
Yeah, I like the digitized voice. Yeah, I want to be honest. A robot. Yeah.
And what happens with M-Flow next?
Well, this is a good question. You know, so after like a year and a half hiatus of us just doing our DJing, what have you, we're thinking about some big shows, you know, towards the end of this year. And
that soon,
and we're in the studio making new songs.
Wow.
Mm. Yeah, we're definitely gonna come back, new songs, new fresh like ideas. So yeah, it should be good. And you're gonna be here for the show.
Yeah, no. I think we'll all be here. Verbal. Yeah. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
You're listening to Monocle Weekly. We're in Tokyo. Back in a moment. Welcome back to the Monocle Weekly here in Tokyo. Well, last week, Japan held its local elections with the most talked about post of Tokyo governor going to 78-year-old incumbent Shintaro Ishihara. One of the unlikely contenders for the same post was the young filmmaker, TV presenter, and political satirist, Yujiro Taniyama. His election campaign, Yujiro Change Tokyo, focused on the importance of internationalism and social media and was an affirmative call to action for Japan's youth to play a more active role in the leadership of their country. He joined us now in studio. Yujiro Taniyama, welcome.
Hello, Tyler.
I guess Fiona and Kenji, we've been writing about it for a while. I think about 4 years ago, just when we launched, we came up with a fictitious politician. We said that that's exactly what this country needed. It needed, hopefully a PM who is under 45. So I'm not sure if that's a post you're going for. You wanted to start with governor of Tokyo. Where did you end up last week?
Well,
when the polls closed.
Well, Mr. Ishihara, he's a 78-year-old dinosaur. He's an old man. But I was the youngest candidate. And Mr. Ishihara, he got 2.6 million votes. And for myself, I got 1/260th. But still, 10,300 votes. Thank you.
That's not bad. I mean, it's a start, and obviously
it's a first challenge. Yes.
Yeah, and it does obviously mean that you'll be getting a post like that probably when you're 70 as well. No, but on a more serious note, part of what you were campaigning for, on one side of course being sort of this youthful face, but also clearly a call to action for young Japanese to. Whether just get out and vote, or simply consider politics themselves, and I'm wondering, when we look at Japan, and of course we've been focusing a lot in this program on the crisis, that it is very much sort of a domain of people who seem to be 60 plus. Why is that?
Well, the fact is, Tyler, one out of four people will be over 65 in 2025 in Tokyo, and this is the unprecedented. Old aging society in the world. And this is very scary, really. As for my part, I knew that I'm 38 right now. I knew that I had to bring young blood inside the society. Otherwise, if you're walking out there in Tokyo, you'll see these old grandmas and grandpas, just like Mr. Ishihara, the selected the governor again. But we're in deep trouble.
How do you mobilize the young people? There's a lot of talk of the voting virgins, people who should have voted years ago but have never voted.
Exactly.
How do you get those people interested
in
politics?
Actually, I was in Egypt last December, and when I came back, there was a revolution. The Jasmine in Tunisia and in Egypt. Young people made that change. But the fact is, on the election days, people go out to onsen or go out there to ski, and they don't go to vote. So... as for my part, I think I can't really call Japan a democratic nation because the voting rate is like in 2007, Tokyo government election was like 54. And that's only half, And this election, because of the tsunami, the radiation, the young generations, when I made speech in like Shibuya Station or Ebisu Station, you see these young guys holding these donation box, for the victims. And this concern, the young generation were complacent till this whole crisis.
Fiona, would you say that Japanese youth are any more or less apathetic than if we went to the Netherlands or we were in Italy or we were in Argentina?
I mean, they do seem very apathetic generally, I have to say. And it's interesting, even the anti-nuclear demonstration last weekend.
In Koenji.
Yeah. And, that was quite an interesting test to see, because everyone you talk to is very, very down on nuclear power now. But even that was, there were a few thousand there, but it wasn't the mass demonstration you might have hoped for. And it was a very, it's a very soft subject. In a way, it's a very easy way. People know exactly what the problem is. And
what you're saying, they didn't have the water cannons out.
They certainly didn't need those. No, it was a very sort of good-spirited event. I mean, I think it must be a real challenge trying to get people to be interested.
Absolutely, Fiona. That anti-nuclear event was created by the music, the musicians to begin with. But to actually change this society, not only the musician, the whole society has to start moving. After the bubble collapsed in the early 1990s, the young generation's going down. They've seen their fathers being fired when they were small. So they forgot to dream. There's no hope. That's the way they believe.
Kenji, are you surprised or are you anesthetized at this point when you see the candidates' posters come up, and of course when they come wailing around your neighborhood, you sort of know it's going to be sort of the same predictable faces?
Yeah, unfortunately, I think that was sort of the outlook from the very beginning. Hmm. I want to ask how difficult it was to campaign, given that there was this element of self-restraint, this jishku, that was imposed on you. Really, you couldn't use the loudspeakers. You know, you couldn't campaign in the traditional way that might have allowed you to
exactly, Kenji-san. The fact is, the media was reporting the tsunami and the radiation. Mm. So for a small candidate like me, unlike Mr. Ishihara, I'm not famous. I'm just an ordinary guy. But for me, it was a big disadvantage. Mm. But there was a turning point 1 week after the campaign. I made a huge mistake on the NHK public address. I forgot my lines. Mm. I'm supposed to be good at it, but I just completely lost it. But that was the only take I could, you know, give it a shot. But somehow...
Oh, dear.
Yeah. But the lucky thing was the Japanese public, they liked it. They liked my mistake, that I'm trying to recover over my mistake. You know, I apologize in front of the public. And in about 4 or 5 days, the YouTube viewers were more than 200,000 or something.
Right.
So when I was walking down the streets, I was at Starbucks in Roppongi. You see these guys taking photos of me, and they're twittering, saying, "Oh, Yujiro Taniyama he's drinking a house blend at the Roppongi. My God, he's not campaigning." But that was a good advertisement for me. Mm. So I think that is one of the big reasons, the social network, the Facebook, the Twitter in Japan, Mixigri, whatever, that led to my, 10,300 votes. It's just a big, big figure for nobody like me.
What happens next then? So, you're going to be heading up north and going into the disaster zone. But politics parked for one side, or do you have more fire in you now than you did before?
Tomorrow, I'll be heading off to Ishinomaki. Mm-hmm. It's one of the most disastrous zones. And I'll have to see for myself what's actually going on and what I can actually do. It might be a really small thing, but because I'm a Japanese citizen, there's something it's an obligation I feel. I'll regret it if I don't go.
Mm-hmm. Are you getting other young people to do the same? I mean, we've seen a lot of young people actually doing this on their own volition, on their own free will. Mm. But how do you, you know, given your status and your popularity, how do you get those other folks to do what you're doing?
Well, Kenji-san, I'll first have to go on my own first with my friends. We're renting a van starting from Roppongi. If you want to go, you give me a call. But, you know, then first I see for myself, seeing is believing. Then I think I will know what kind of action I should take. Mm. And about the political side, I have no idea, Tyler. You know, this is, I just, while I was defeated in this big war for me, I'll see. But one thing for sure, Tyler-san, is that I will be sending messages. That's what I'm here for.
Mm. So we're going to see YouTube, regular YouTube updates and tweets.
Yes. But my voice will not sound like this. I sound like Boy George, don't I? My voice sounds better, right, Fiona? You know that.
I'm not sure if that's Boy George behind bars or not. But I mean, that's a whole other topic. Yeah. Fiona, I just wanted to ask you, obviously, Yujiro-san, a rather sort of different face on the scene, but welcome in the mix.
Definitely. I mean, you know, it was funny as the candidates' posters started popping up. You did get the feeling of deja vu, really, didn't you? Dr. Nakamatsu and Mr. Ishihara. I mean, you know, of course, no one was sure if Mr. Ishihara was actually going to stand until just before the election. And then once he'd announced, and he basically said, "I'm just going to be doing the same thing for the next 4 years." Mm. And that was the campaign platform. And at the moment, that seemed to be all that was needed, actually, wasn't
Absolutely.
It?
Absolutely. So ex-governors, they all won, none of them. I think in times of these crises, they've got this advantage.
Sure.
More than change, they want stability or safety. Mm. In a way, as Fiona-san just said, I believe that real change has slowed down in that sense, if Mr. Ishihara is going to do the same thing. But at the same time, Tyler, I think this is a big chance, a big opportunity for Japan to change in the means of the energy resources. The most important thing is our mentality. All my friends in Japan, they we're sharing this emotion that we have to do something. Mm. And this is something we, the Japanese, hadn't experienced for a long time. Over 27,000 people said to be passed away. We can't let those deaths, what do you say, meaningless. We have to find meaning for those deaths. Why the TEPCO, the top guys out there, they were so slow. The Japanese media, mostly, like the TV commercials, TV programs, they've been funded by TEPCO. That's why many TV commentators in Japanese TV world cannot comment really harshly. You know, this whole structure has to start changing. Otherwise, the death of these 20,000 or even more people, this will be just so meaningless. We can't let that happen.
And are you confident that there will be change? Earlier in the program, we were talking with another guest, and well, I think we all discussed it. Round table. Some have said that maybe isn't this crisis. Despite we're talking about maybe over 30,000 people, this has not been a big enough event to bring real change to Japan. And I'm wondering what your view is.
Well, Tyler, I'm absolutely against that. Whoever said that, I don't know who it is, but I think he has no insight to what's actually going on in this country. I have been campaigning for over 2 weeks, walking all around Tokyo, listening to the voices of the people. And what I felt, the only hope I felt during campaign was that we, the Japanese, we're sharing this new emotion, a passion we never had before, that we have to unite to start a new life. Because we're recording this in a studio in Tokyo. These electricity, most of them come from Tohoku area, and the nuclear plants, they've stopped right now. And if they don't recover, we don't recover. This summer, the aircon, we can't recharge our PSP this summer.
Won't be using it as a meter.
I think given the chunky jump you're on, you're sort of doing pre-acclimatization, sort of put all the layers on now, and then everything will feel very cool by the time July comes around.
I know.
Listen, best of luck up north.
Thank you, Tyler. Thank you
very much. Posted.
Thank you.
This is the Monaco Weekly. You're back after this. Back with the Monaco Weekly in Tokyo, where it's almost time to say goodbye to Fiona and Kenji. But before we go, Fiona, I very hard to look into the crystal ball. I'm not even sure if you put it in your bag today or not. But do you think that this is aside from, of course, any significant aftershocks, of which there were a few this week as well, which is quite remarkable.
So many, yeah. It's been a real a busy week.
We were down in Kagoshima, there was, first there was sort of a rumbling at about, I guess it was sort of about midnight. And then, of course, you've got the volcano down there, which also decided to kick off
just
the next morning.
Just to add to the excitement.
I know, because you sort of heard, I'm not sure, it was, this its own sort of letting off of steam or what it was, but it was all rather prehistoric.
There were more than 300 aftershocks, from during the month after the major earthquake and tsunami. So, and these are of the level 5 on the seismic scale or more powerful. So, it's just unsettling, I think, for a lot of people. There's actually a term. It's jishin yoi, which means, quake drunk. And it refers to these people who can't really, they have their sea legs. They can't really get a sense of sort of that their feet are on the ground because it's moving so often.
It is quite something. And I think there's another side as well, which I do get a sense from some people I've met who are nowhere near the disaster zones, but are also just quite shell-shocked as well. There's a sort of just real fear that people who've sort of been through this, you don't want to have it happen again.
No, it's so true. Obviously in Tokyo, we weren't at the epicenter, but it's interesting, there has been some kind of collective trauma. It's really hard to put your finger on it yet, but it's just emerging. It's taking a while to come through in a way. And I think in the early stages, people would be just dealing with the situation and being quite practical. But I notice now there's more of an emotional response.
Actually. Yeah. We were talking about it off air that, you are seeing more gaijin returning. And I certainly did, when I was talking to some hotel GMs, they said the food and beverage side is returning, but they said rooms not yet. And if there are rooms, it's Japanese guests. And so, you know, it is sort of, you know, businessmen, you know, re-engaging and starting to travel around the country. But certainly, you know, international business is not back yet. And that's not happening. And I'm wondering, you know, do we sort of drift through summer at this point, do you think? And then will it be sort of, you know, Northern Hemisphere, you know, autumn comes around. Yeah, I guess we should probably go to Japan for the last quarter. I wonder if that's what we're up for here. Yeah.
Well, I think a lot of it depends on what happens with the nuclear power plant.
Mm.
At this point, TEPCO isn't really saying, Tokyo Electric Power isn't really saying when it's going to stabilize things. But there have been reports that it could happen as soon as June. You know, after which they would begin the process of entombing these reactors. But it's going to take years. And so the question is, you know, when do people start coming back and flocking to hotels and going to tourist destinations?
Yeah, I mean, I think in the short term, you know, I read an article that's saying that 500,000 hotel rooms have been cancelled.
Yeah, these
cancelled.
Half a million hotel.
Yeah, did you see that as well? And it's not just foreign tourists, it's domestic tourists. It'll be interesting with Golden Week coming up, which is a really big holiday in Japan. Usually people travel all over the country. I mean, that might be quite an interesting time. But I think probably the summer is going to be a bit strange still.
I think it'll be different as well when everyone's already, you know, saying, you know, don't come because it's going to be so bloody hot because, you know, air conditioning won't be working. And I wanted to go back to just you know, one final point, though. It's and, you know, we don't want to end the show on a downer either, because, you know, there was a piece on the BBC, you know, when I got here last Friday, which was talking about sakura season and that, you know, people were not going out. And, you know, there were sort of these pans through various parks and boulevards and, you know, and they were quite empty. But that wasn't the scene last weekend here. I mean, I mean, it was in the south of the country. It was in Kagoshima. I came back, you know, you and I were chatting, and, you know, through the Aoyama Cemetery, it was heaving. And also, you know, the stores were busy, and, you know, you go into hotel lobbies, you can see that, you know, the F&B side is working. I mean, this is the other side of it as well, is that life is pretty normal too.
Yeah, I think.
Or there's a new normal, or whatever you want to call it.
Yeah, it's a new normal. And I think people were really craving. It's so true what you said about last weekend. It was a really beautiful Sunday. And in spite of the fact that we've been told we shouldn't really be doing cherry blossom celebrations or picnics or anything, there were so many people out in the cemetery and the mood was really quite light. And there was a sense of relief, actually, I think. I don't know if you were thinking
that. I got that same sense as well, yeah. I went to Yasukuni Jinja, and I also went to Chidori Kafuchi, which is this area. It's a moat that's surrounded by cherry blossom trees, and it was absolutely packed.
Mm.
So I think people did have the sense of, you know, is it appropriate for us to go out and check out the cherry blossoms? And ultimately, it was just too nice of a day not to.
Yeah.
Well, we were doing, we had a talk at one of the embassies earlier in the week, and I think that, you know, that's what it is going to take, though. I think there can be as many donations and there can be as many, you know, mini summits to talk about the future of Brand Japan, but I think people just have to get on planes and come and stay in hotels and just re-engage with the place.
Exactly, yeah.
Hopefully. Anyway.
I went running today.
Oh, that's good.
Quite something for Kenji.
Yeah, okay, well, that's good. Well, I'm going to join you tomorrow. That's all for this week's edition of the Monocle Weekly in Tokyo. Today's show was produced by Alex Mills in London, and our sound editor was Chris Sharp at the Sound Company. And also a big thank you to everyone here at FM Studios for so graciously hosting us today in Tokyo. If you have any thoughts or comments for today's show, then do drop us a note to weekly@monocle.com. And remember, you can catch up with us daily via our Monocle on our site. Next week, we're back in London for another production week with the royal wedding upon us. Do you want to come over, Fiona? And you know, you could do sort of, we could sort of be in one of the boxes and sort of, you know, commenting. And I thought it'd be kind of interesting, actually. You know?
Oh, mind a front row seat. I'm embarrassed to say I did stand in the street at Charles and Diana's wedding.
Did you?
1981, yes. Little girl, I thought it was very exciting.
Oh, yeah. Very good. Well, anyway, for now, for all of us in Tokyo, I'm Tyler Brulé.
I'm Kenji Hall.
I'm Fiona Wilson.
And here to play us out is a little something again from Verbal. The song is called You Are.